found these paintings rolled up under the beds of old widows, buried in family trash. These were forbidden works by artists who stayed true to their vision at a terrible cost.
I'm speaking with Amanda Pope and Chabjak Gyuliev, who wrote, produced, and directed the new documentary film, The Desert of Forbidden Art. And Amanda, you directed it, and Shavda, you produced it.
No, we all did it together.
You did
totally,
it together.
Yeah, that's the great thing. Across generations, Ian.
So there were no pulling rank and ego conflicts?
Absolutely not, you know.
Well, it's shocking.
A shock. It is a beautiful film. I mean, the art, of course, is where the beauty resides. And even on the screen, it just overwhelms you.
Especially on the screen. This is where we had some wonderful fortune technologically, because this HD medium really makes the art look gorgeous. It really makes the colors pop out.
And this museum is so far out there in the desert that this is an incredible opportunity for American audiences to see this art.
Well, that's what's so extraordinary about this whole extraordinary story of the desert of forbidden art, this hidden treasure in this remote part of Uzbekistan, in a town that I had never heard of. And there you have this extraordinary treasure that's been preserved by this sort of unusual Russian.
Protected, really. Protected both by the man who, Igor Savitsky, who rescued the art, and also by the present director, who Savitsky turned over the directorship of the museum to when she was 26.
What's really interesting that a lot of people, even in Russia, haven't heard about this city, Nukus, which is in the middle of the Karakum and Kizilkum Desert, very far away from any kind of big centers. And that is what enabled Igor Savitsky to start collecting this art, because there nobody knew what he had.
Sure.
This was the only museum in the Soviet Union that was exhibiting illegal art bought on government money and prominently featured on display.
Well, that, of course, is the genius of this subversive man, was that he went down there in the 20s, I think it was, as an anthropologist. And
50s. He was there in the 50s, though originally he was an art student. In World War II, he was evacuated from Moscow as an art student, which is what the Soviets did, which is quite wonderful. All their art community, they evacuated to the south to protect them.
In the 50s, then, he starts building this museum. He somehow cons these apparatchiks into giving him all this money. He then goes and rescues these treasures that were banned by Stalin as bourgeois art, and actually managed to provide the widows and orphans of these great artists some kind of stipend. And then he gets it all in the train and the trucks and brings back. And now you have this amazing treasure in the middle of nowhere, put together by this interesting fellow and preserved by this equally interesting woman that you profile in your film, The Desert of Forbidden Art. And now I learned from last Tuesday's New York Times that this great art treasure is in danger yet again. It survived Stalin, but is it going to survive the Uzbek bureaucrats?
Well, just to give you an idea, this is the second largest collection of Russian avant-garde art in the world, and it has over 40,000 paintings and graphics.
And what's fascinating is not all of them are masterpieces, because you have to know that Igor Savitsky was obsessive, deeply obsessive. I mean, anyone who single-handedly, he didn't have money of his own. He didn't have, he didn't have a whole crew of people. He brought those paintings rolled up by the thousands with him. He carried them on his back. And people used to think he was a porter. And then he got him down there, framed them. He had individual IOUs. And when he died, we found his doctor living here in Los Angeles. And Dr. Funi said that as he was dying, Savitsky said, "I can't die. I owe over a million rubles." And Maronika, the present director's first job for the first 15 years that she was director of that museum, was to pay back the IOUs.
And this is in a new post-Soviet environment where this art is now suddenly incredibly valuable. You have a lot of Russian billionaires, right? And they'd like to get their whole hands on some of this stuff, and they're trying. Is that right?
You're absolutely right, Ian. We get phone calls from Russian oligarchs every now and then. And what is amazing is they don't take no for an answer. All they know is how much, and we'll call you next week. And we try to explain that all we're trying to do is preserve this collection and bring the world's attention to what's going there at the moment, which is rather unfortunate.
So, Amanda, is the value of this collection the subtext for this bizarre behavior on the part of the Uzbek government that now they've essentially run trucks up to the back of the building, taken this stuff out, saying that the building's condemned even though it's in perfectly good shape? Have they fired this wonderful woman that's preserved this collection?
No. The reality is there were two museum buildings. The one that they have condemned was the original building that Savitsky had, which was from 1966, and it wasn't in the greatest shape. When you saw them pouring water under trays to give the proper humidity to the paintings, I mean, we're not talking about high-class air conditioning. But on the other hand, what was so valuable about this building is that the storage rooms were there, the restoration lab was there, and also a number of paintings that the Uzbek government had indicated to the director they would just as soon not have go on display. They are in that old museum. And so the real issue is what we hope our film and this media attention can cause is for the Uzbek government to adopt a progressive attitude and say, hey, wait a minute, this is a major tourist attraction, rather than disapproving of it because so many of the artists are Russian and the Russians were the Uzbeks' former colonials. Why don't we just say, hey, folks, we have the Silk Road masterpiece cities, and now you have the Savitsky collection in the desert. Come and see them all. And, you know, they can laugh all the way to the bank. It's tourist dollars.
So, Chavda, do you think that they're safe or there's not going to be another peculiar kind of purge? Or?
Well, at the moment, the works are safe, even though a lot of them are stored literally in the hallways of the new building. But in a larger scope, 97% of the collection is in dire need of restoration. And now with the restoration lab gone, there's not even any plans for this work continuing. Uzbekistan as a country is in a very volatile region in Central Asia. It borders on Afghanistan, and there's some Islamic fundamentalism next door. And this is a collection of 20th century contemporary non-representational art.
Sure. And then there's a sequence in the film where the Taliban blow up the Buddhas in Bamiyan, and it just shocked you when you see that. And you're reminded of that. And you know that that impulse is there. So it is tenuous, right? And what about all this sudden publicity that your film has brought it and the New York Times has brought it? What kind of protection does that provide?
Well, just to update your listeners, not only was the building vacated at a 40-hour notice, but the director of the museum was forbidden from coming to the United States for the opening of the film at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, which was an incredible honor for the Uzbek government and for the achievements of Uzbekistan in preserving this collection, but she was not allowed to travel.
Was the Uzbek ambassador there?
No. I mean, the Uzbek government, 2 weeks before she was going to come, she had her ticket, she had her U.S. visa, and she was forbidden to travel. And indirect approaches were made to us about the possibility of the Uzbek diplomats coming to the screening at the Wharton National Gallery. And what we said is what you have to be prepared for if you come is there are going to be questions about why your government has forbidden, you know, the director from coming here. It was such a wonderful event honoring Uzbekistan, you know, and honoring the culture. But, you know, there are progressive forces in the country and there are reactionary forces. And what we hope the film will do, and in answer to your question, the publicity, is to let the Uzbek government see how much interest there is and encourage them to support this museum rather than try and, I don't know.
It feels, though, more like a Soviet impulse than an Islamist one or a corrupt oligarchical one in terms of the new political mix there. Again, I'm speaking with Amanda Pope and Shavdar Gyulyev, who wrote, produced, and directed the new documentary film together, The Desert of Forbidden Art, an extraordinary film that brings to life these art treasures that Stalin banned and that were rescued by this amazing Russian former anthropologist turned art collector that ended up in this museum in the middle of nowhere in the new Republic of Uzbekistan. Is it possible, though, Shavdar, that there was a little bit of a reaction to the... I thought it was so tragic that the Uzbek artist that became one of Stalin's favorites, because he did all that neorealistic stuff that they love, you know, the brave tractor driver and all that stuff, his earlier works are just spectacular. I mean, they just, they're, I mean, I'm looking at your video and I can't believe how beautiful they are. And then, of course, he became successful as a propagandist, not a painter. And he returns finally to see his work, this extraordinary work that was saved by this Russian. And at this point, he has a chauffeured limousine and it drives him all the way to the museum. And guess what happens? He has a heart attack before he gets to see his earlier works. Such a poetic irony.
We couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, reality is so much more interesting than what you can make up. I mean, what we had to do is reenact that scene. And we found an 80-year-old man here in Los Angeles who had a Dodge car that was exactly the model that the Soviets had for their cars in that period. And Chavi had a friend who was a sculptor who made us an authentic Soviet license plate.
Well, you fooled me. I tell you, I thought, boy... How do they get this footage?
But what's really interesting, he has a museum to himself with a communist monument in front of it, the communist statue of himself, and a medal for being a hero of the Soviet Union. And inside this museum, there's two stories of paintings, two floors of paintings, but none of them are at the level of the works, over 600 incredible, fauvist, beautiful, colorful works of Tansigbaev, of Ural Tansigbaev on Central Asia and the Silk Road. And what also was very interesting, as we saw his photographs as a young man, he was a very thin-looking young man. And as he grew older and became more socialist, realist, and showered by the government with all kinds of honors and awards, he grew in size.
Right.
So in the film, we refer to him as the fat cat.
But it feels like his soul was eroded over the years. And that's what I'm wondering about, whether there is this sort of embarrassment amongst the former Soviet elite who have essentially become the ruling cliques, haven't they, in these countries? They're former Soviet apparatchiks who are now running the place. Is there an element of that they're embarrassed by their past? Is that possible?
No.
Or maybe these people aren't capable of embarrassing.
They're very realistic people, kind of down to earth. I mean, indeed, the president of Uzbekistan was the first secretary of the Communist Party before the fall of the Soviet Union. But the artists themselves, it is incredible that they stay true to their vision despite all odds. They were persecuted, thrown in gulags, in mental hospitals, because surely if they paint works like this, they must be deranged.
Right.
Some of them were even shot for things like believing in God or for homosexuality. This was considered a crime in the Soviet Union. But despite all of those odds, they stayed true to their vision. And the irony is that the Soviet Union is gone, and now their works are worth millions of dollars.
The film is opening
the 18th here at the Music Hall. Mm-hmm. And I should say one thing that is kind of wonderful. Here, this whole story could not have been made were we not connected with USC. I'm on the faculty there. Chavi was my former student. John Bolt, who is the foremost authority on Russian avant-garde, he's in Slavic languages. And USC really encouraged the whole project. And so it's kind of marvelous because, you know, you don't think of the Trojans in Nukus in the Karakum Desert, but, you know, we get around.
Right. Well, it would be the equivalent of what having the Museum of Modern Art in whereabouts, somewhere in the New Mexico desert or something. Yeah, like Los Alamos, I guess.
South Dakota.
South Dakota. That's even better. Right. South Dakota. So just in closing, though, I'm curious as to whether in Russia itself, in Moscow, amongst the new capitalists, there's any kind of movement to rescue this art, to preserve it, or to even to bring it back to Moscow. What's the explanation for what appears to be an absence of interest on the part of the new Russians, and the only people that seem to care about this stuff are here in America and in other parts of the world?
Oh, the new Russians are very interested in
it. Yeah, they can get their hands on it.
And as Marinika, the director of the museum, says, they have very good taste. They're usually after the best works, and they know exactly which ones those are. We only hope the film hasn't screened in Russia, only in one place. And we only hope that the attention it's getting in the West will make Russians appreciate their own cultural treasure that is now in Uzbekistan.
But it should be preserved for Russians to see, not for billionaires to hang in their private palaces.
We have a story like this in the film where a painting that is not from the Nukus Museum is sold at an auction in Moscow. It's by one of the major artists of the museum, but it's from a private collection. And the son of the artist says that now the painting is sold. We don't know who has it. We don't know when people would ever be able to enjoy it again. We don't know where it is anymore.
Right, and he mentions, makes an allusion to Van Gogh. This artist had nothing during his lifetime, and now his art's worth hundreds, millions of dollars, right?
But you notice when that son made that remark, he didn't say, oh, this painting was sold for $500,000 and our family didn't get any of it. That was not the remark he made. The remark he made was now the public cannot see it. Now people cannot see it. And that is really such an expression of the true Russian love of art.
Right, and which couldn't have been more embodied by this extraordinary man that you profile in the film, Igor Savitsky. Thank you both for joining us in the studio.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Pope and Shavdar Gilyev, who wrote, produced, and directed the new documentary film, The Desert of Forbidden Art, opening March 18th here in Los Angeles at the Lemley. This new documentary, The Desert of Forbidden Art, will also be offered as a KPFK Film Club selection when it's released in Los Angeles on March the 18th. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments, and I would love to know what you think. I'll be back on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.